Welcome to the Supply Chain Pioneers Podcast, where we highlight industry leaders on the forefront of innovation and technology in planning, procurement, and logistics. Hosted by your supply chain pro to know, Ulf Venn.
Currently Vice President at Schaeffler in charge of risk management and sustainability. I would like to tell the story that I studied logistics supply chain management at the German Army, but my mom put a veto on that. I kind of took the detour through strategic marketing, supply chain management. It's a really fascinating field because it allows me to leverage my interest for people, what makes people move, go around.
Supply Chain Pioneers is powered by Everstream Analytics. Everstream gives you the predictive insights and analytics to make your supply chain faster, smarter, safer, and leaner. Go to everstream.ai to book your demo today. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Supply Chain Pioneers. And with me today, I have Nadine Kirati-Schneider, who's a Vice President of Supply Chain Risk Management and Sustainability by Schaeffler. Welcome, Nadine.
Hi there, Ulf. Very happy to be here.
So, Nadine, as it is always the case with our podcast, could you quickly introduce yourself for the listeners and viewers?
Sure. So you mentioned currently Vice President at Schaeffler in charge of risk management and sustainability with a focus on transportation management. I was born and raised in Aachen, which is kind of my home base. From there, I always had an international lookout. I've been living in Istanbul, Turkey, to brush up my Turkish father's language. I've lived in the States for a year. I've lived abroad in the Netherlands, where I also did my studies. So in a nutshell, I feel like a global citizen. Maybe interesting to know regarding the podcast drew me to supply chain management. I would like to tell the story that I studied logistics supply chain management at the German Army, but my mom put a veto on that. Quickly, what brought me to the supply chain? I kind of took the detour through strategic marketing that I studied at Maastricht University, which in the end was really good. Because in this way, I was able to only reach supply chain management issues after having studied the customer perspective, you know, what you have to do, what companies ought to do, can do to leverage their competencies to serve customers. And only in the last semester of that strategic marketing master study at Maastricht Universities, I came across B2B business courses that touch supply chain management, value chain management, Porter's Five Forces, Porter Value Chain, you name it. And that really excited me just at the end of my studies that I was thinking, what next? And I really had a difficult time deciding what to do after my studies. Should I go for consulting to see many different companies, different sectors, to then decide what to do? I didn't even know which industry or position to apply to. And then I think my interest caught the attention of my thesis supervisor, who then asked me to pursue a PhD in purchasing and supply management. And that was great at the time because that allowed me gave me another 4 years that allowed me to deepen my knowledge, interest, expertise into B2B, specifically in the purchasing supply management sector, which then, of course, is part of supply chain management. And that's how I kind of got stuck to supply chain management. And it's a really fascinating field because it allows me to leverage my interest for people, what makes people move, go around, how to bring together people, because supply chain, value chain management is all about connecting people, working in networks, not only in a chain, a linear fashion. It's all about international context, trying to understand different contexts. And I'm really, really happy that my path took me via strategic marketing to purchasing and then to supply chain management, and now actually working for a global company where I can actually have an actual taste of it. It's really fun to work in supply chain management.
And I think the good thing about marketing actually is also that it prepared you already for the corporate role you have now, where a lot of your work is instilling change. And I do believe you need some some marketing abilities and sales abilities to be able to drive change and make sure people are trying to follow new ideas and new guidelines. So I think that's actually a perfect combination, but we come to that a little bit later as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. But before we get into what you're doing right now, let's maybe look back in time to your a university career and especially your PhD study, where you have researched around unlocking creativity in supply chain teams, which is a great, you already talked about connecting people.
Yeah.
It's overall a great topic because the supply chains still have a lot of humans in the mix. So for you, what are, based on the research, key criteria of creating a space where people can smoothly operate in this high pressure scenario that is supply chain management?
To give a bit of background on how the topic originated, I initially started to study social media use in procurement and how purchasing professionals could leverage that. I mean, that's some time back, right? We're talking about, what's that, 10 years, a bit more mm-hmm. than 10 years that I started my PhD studies. And I think that's when the social media hype really just got started, also to catch fire in the business life. But I quickly realized there's not so much meat into it. During my initial 2-3 months on the PhD trajectory, doing some research on what kind of topics business professionals are pursuing on social media, it was innovation. And what really caught my attention at that time, I always loved the topic of innovation management, is that many purchasing professionals talked about how they're not managing to get innovation out of their sourcing teams, out of their suppliers, that they put so much money into programs. And that was intriguing to me at the time. And I told my PhD supervisors back then, give me some time to explore if there's something in it. So I went, talked to some of the C-suite level managers in the Unilevers, Procter & Gamble's, you name it. I was fortunate enough to be exposed to that professional network through my PhD supervisor, who was also part-time working at consulting. And what came back was that everyone focuses on the innovation process, but no one or few people looked at the initiation part of innovation, which is the creation of ideas and the ideation process, so to say. And I was like, I think there is an opening for me to do research that is A, relevant, because everyone needs innovation, whether that's procurement or other parts of the supply chain. Apparently, there's a big struggle in how to make innovation work. And few people are looking into the issues with innovation. And there we had a few working hypotheses that I gathered from procurement professionals, that it might be creativity or the lack thereof, mm-hmm. And also the lack of understanding how you can control, steer, navigate creativity, and how you can instill it in people. So topic idea was born. My PhD supervisor was excited about that because he's also a people connector. And then together we went about in developing the concept for the PhD trajectory. And the first thing that I did is I did a study to develop something that's called Team Creativity Climate. Climate studies are well known. I think they've been around since the mid-80s or something. And climate is something that can not only happen in corporates, right? That's typically corporate culture, what you're talking about. That takes some time to change, but climates, they can happen in a microspace mm-hmm. within teams and departments. It's much easier to control, to steer, and also to ignite compared to cultures. So that was the first thing that I developed, something that's called Team Creativity Climate. It's a measurement scale developed through interviews and also quantitative studies. It has 9 items that you go through. And it has things like that it enables a team member to rate the behavior that the team displays. For instance, we build on each other's ideas. We make room for each other's ideas. We take different perspectives, those kind of things. So that was the first thing we did. The second thing I did, the second study, was all about finding out how can you actually manage, how can you stimulate the team creativity climate. And there we looked at 4 factors. We looked at the creative capabilities that the individual team members bring. We looked at the task expertise, the level of knowledge expertise that individual team members bring. That was the driving factors. And then we looked at two, what we call in research, moderating factors. So it's kind of contingency factors that can cause these two factors having a stronger or a weaker effect on team creativity climate. It was leadership behavior, mm-hmm. and it was functional diversity. So the number of functions present in a team. And what was super interesting to see is that if you only look at task expertise and creative capabilities, that creative capabilities that team members bring, they actually had the strongest impact compared to task expertise. Now, if you bring in the leadership perspective and also the functional diversity aspect, it's really interesting to see that it flips. Suddenly, task expertise is the single most dominant predictor of team creativity climate, especially when you have multiple functions present in a team. So let's say you have an accountant, you have a marketeer, you have an operations guy, maybe someone from marketing. And the mechanism behind it, what we found out is that if you have different people coming together from different expertise and they have a heterogeneous allocation, so not one single function is dominant, people have to start to talk to each other and take each other's perspective, use language to explain each other their own expertise knowledge so that the others can actually do something with that. And that actually entices team creativity climate and invites people over a time span. We didn't measure what time span it was. That was not the focus back then, to really build this team creativity climate. So that on functional diversity. And the other aspect, the behavior of the leader, is that it was really interesting, and we did some follow-up studies to find out what happened there. We saw that the leader's behavior had a negative impact on team members using their creative capability to induce a team creativity climate. I do a bit of a cliffhanger moment here. So why is that? People can think about that. But we did a follow-up study to find out in which phases of the creative process does which team leadership style help most. And we found out that in the beginning, the ideation phase, when people come together and they have to chip in all of their perspectives to come up with different alternatives, it's the more charismatic, transformational leadership style that empowers people and enables them to feel safe in a team to share their ideas. Whereas towards the end, it's all about, you know, getting things done. A transactional leadership style helps. Once you have an idea, you've boiled it down to one alternative you want to pursue, you need someone who says, like, okay, timeline is here. This is the resources. You do this. Let's control the outcome. And that was really intriguing to find. So in a nutshell, that was the result of the second study that we did in the PhD.
That's very interesting, especially the different leadership styles, which is, I think, hard to apply for some people, because, I mean, first you have to be charismatic, and then you also have to be a little bit hard and clear and to the point. So it's a very unique combination. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe one thing to this, it sounds like you have to be a bit schizophrenic as a leader. Yes and no. The good thing is that this kind of concept of adapting your leadership style to the situation is called situational leadership. And that has been well researched. And in the context of creativity and making teams creative, we actually delivered empirical evidence that even there it works and it makes sense. And of course, it takes training and also self-reflection as a leader that you are able to adjust your style to the context.
Yeah, but it also is nice to hear that creativity needs a certain amount of pragmatism in order to work, which is great. So I love being pragmatic. That's a German in me. Okay, so moving on, because we now have talked about creativity, but at one point you moved away from being somewhat creative to join the real supply chain world where it's all about operations, but you did that with a very strategic spin, because you started architecting a very large scale inbound supply chain at Schaeffler, which is a big task all by itself. Yeah. But doing that during COVID, which was essentially your entry into the operational world, must have been a very unique experience. So what did you How did that feel for you, and what experience have you made then and now, actually, when the climate is a little bit better for supply chains?
First of all, I was very happy to have that opportunity because when I was after the PhD, I pursued an assistant professorship at Maastricht University. And during that time, I had lots of contact with companies that are advised on creativity, innovation, leveraging procurement teams, connecting them with the other functions, such as logistics. That's typically of procurement. You have logistics or supply chain management. They're not connected in many companies. So I was happy to bring that perspective to the real world, as you say. We academics, I mean, I still consider myself a pracademic, practitioner, academic, pracademic. We sometimes smile because it's also real stuff that we work on, right? So just a side note on that. It was scary, to be frank. Because if you move from academia to an industry job, there's all sorts of expectations, also prejudices, stereotypes around you. Maybe you're a theory head, you cannot, you know, get stuff done. And I think the most important point for me back then was to listen. Because back then there was no corporate inbound organization. And I first listened for the first two or three months. I went to all the different stakeholders on the procurement side, but also on the supply chain management side, where I was headquartered in, right? So I built up inbound organization to logistically integrate suppliers from a supply chain management point of view. And naturally, purchasing colleagues were my natural allies. So I went and listened. I talked to, where do you see your job starting? Where do you see your job ending? What would you see would be my job? What would be your expectation? Where can I help you? Where do you have open questions? Is there issues? Is there conflict? So that's what I did for the first 2 or 3 months, which also was important. You mentioned it was during COVID. So I didn't get to see people face to face. There was still lots of restrictions. But I still went to the office 5 days a week in the first half year or so to make sure if someone comes in, I would actually be able to meet them face to face, which made the difference. If you can look people in the eye once, the conversation afterwards is different. So conversation, listening, and then I took stock to understand where could I position this organization that needs to be the bridge between purchasing and supply chain management. And then it was finding a thread for telling a storyline, a common thread that would go through. And the common thread for me was like, guys, listen, I basically go through supply chain management, logistics, and I have a look at what they need from suppliers. So I write down the logistics shopping list, and I give this to our purchasing friends and explain the different elements to them so that they can go and shop this from our suppliers. And that narrative that was understood, it was easy to understand, right? People didn't have to get the exact content of what I was doing, but only when it was relevant for them. And that was really helpful at that time. So my natural interest for new content, seeing things end to end, right? I mean, I started with strategic marketing, went procurement and supply chain management. I think those things really helped me. And also help to fight the prejudice and stereotypes that if someone comes from academia to go into an industrial position, that they can actually bring something. And I've been trying to advocate the connect that practitioners and academicians can actually do more and more.
Interesting. Very good. So maybe let's move to the next topic to today, actually. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing today is you're responsible for risk and sustainability. Mm-hmm. Let's maybe talk about both topics and start with risk. So what are the three risks that currently keep you up at night?
Yeah. I mean, we're speaking at a time where especially geopolitical conflicts are huge. Not only from a professional point of view, but also as a private person, I'm worried about the developments in the world, because we're all citizens of this planet. But of course, in being a professional and being in charge of risk management for transportation for a global company, you have to have those on your radar. It's particularly, of course, the conflict that we have now in the Middle East that's caused the Houthi rebels shooting at cargo ships from Yemen, from mainland, and their threat to widen their assaults on the Indian Ocean. That is something that should keep every professional up at night that is in the supply chain sector largely, because we're the ones responsible for making things go round and to ensure business continuity. Business professionals have to have a look at it. And I think while one thing is to keep it in on the radar for short-term measures and also proactively prepare for things that could happen, to prepare the supply chain for continuation, finding different alternatives, different routes. I think at large, the world probably needs to also think about where we source, where do we buy our stuff, where do we get our things. My personal wish is that we as a society, we think more about these kind of things, because it actually helps to take off some pressure of global supply chains as a whole. And at least it takes out trade as a pressure point that nations that are trying to push through with their interests can use to blackmail the world in a way. So that's one big thing. The other big thing is weather. I mean, if you look at the climate, how it's been developing the last 3 years, it's crazy. Forecast, think for the hurricane season on the Atlantic Ocean are off the charts this year. So that's something to worry about. And this is, I mean, we're going to talk about it in a bit. This is at least something that we all can, you know, where we can all contribute to by looking at our behavior. What do we do to emit CO2? What could we potentially do to reduce our emission of CO2? Does this, you know, additional vacation, the flight, I don't know, somewhere, does it have to be every year or twice a year? What about the products that we purchase? So you see, again, I cannot jump out of this role that I had back then, you know, looking at things holistically. I started with strategic marketing, starting with a consumer perspective, and it's still in me. So even though I'm kind of upstream somewhere in operations, supply chain management, I still think about the repercussions regarding consumers. So these two big things: national geopolitical conflicts and the climate that's getting more and more extreme.
Good. Okay, then let's do two and not three. But yeah, I mean, the Panama Canal obviously also being a big issue. I think you already
absolutely. So maybe a word on the Panama Canal. Obviously that's a consequence from the climate change, right? So we have the issue in the Panama Canal that it's run by freshwater that is taken from the two adjacent lakes that are there. And that is, of course, preventing nearby cities of having enough water, for instance. That's one thing. The other hardcore business consequence you have is that you have longer waiting times. It's just not safe, right? You cannot bet on Panama Canal getting your goods from A to B in time. Ships also start to detour, right? So they might be sitting there for 5 days and then decide, hey, let's take the detour around the south tip of Africa to go to Asia. And that adds another 10 days or something on the transit time. You cannot afford, you know, doing this poker game as a big corporate. So that's why you need to find different ways to circumvent the Panama Canal.
Yeah. It's also just better for the locals if you do that, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which brings us to our next topic, being better for locals, being better for planet Earth, a lot of things that sustainability wants to achieve, which is another thing you're doing, and especially your focus is on greener logistics,
yes,
which plays a bigger and bigger role in the mind of consumers, right? I mean, people still want to consume, but do it with a better conscience. So that now that you're walking the talk there, what are some of the challenges you've seen for green logistics today? Why is it we still should reduce our consumption where possible? And but what is already done, and what will what are we missing out on right now?
Where to start with this? Maybe with a more philosophical outlook on this. I mean, you could either try to work on consumers, that they demand less, you know, products to be moved around the globe. But I think this, let's be honest, this is very difficult to change. And people are afraid that things are taken away from them, right? As yeah. soon as consumers get the feeling you take something away from them, like if you disprivilege them, you rob them from privileges, that's not good. They tend to go into the opposite. The other option is that businesses work on the way on how they operate their business, and they need to be done in a more sustainable way, the operations. So let's start with the latter one. I think that's easier. We also have a mandate as corporations to do so. And that's also manifested by things like the Green Deal, right? In Europe, European Union, that were agreed on. Business, especially in my position, green logistics, there's lots of leverage that you can pull. And with all these targets for reaching neutrality by 2040 or 2050 for many of the companies that I've seen left and right, that's good, but of course a big challenge. So I think the most important as regards to sustainability challenge is to get transparency over what you actually emit. That's the basis. If you get transparency of your emissions, that you know what is the largest cause for your emissions, then second, find out what levers do you have. I mean, if it's air, sea, train, you have to find out what's the biggest portion of logistics, and then find out what does the market offer in terms of technologies and different alternatives, either carbon neutral or better, at least from the balance when you look at it, compared to what you have now. And then, of course, you need to be very strategic in making up a roadmap that you measure yourself against, right? Mm. Because you need to set targets. Once you have transparency over what you emit, you need to see when can you reach what and in which way do you want to reduce those emissions. And that brings me to a challenge that companies, of course, face. Most of the, if not almost all of the carbon neutral or carbon better options, they cost money. It's a markup that you have to pay on most of these things. If you talk about e-truck technology, you know, BEV, battery electric vehicles, if you talk about SAF, sustainability aviation fuel, it all costs a premium. So you need to find out how you can actually, you know, account for these additional costs to occur. In my ideal world, there would be a split between all parties in the supply chain. But of course, we're not there yet. There's pioneers that move ahead. And certainly at Schaeffler, we're moving ahead. We have quite aggressive targets. We're on a very good way in reaching them. But that needs commitment from every yeah. side. And also where possible that you can do this cost-wise, that you do it.
Yeah. Now, also, I mean, I do agree the premium is there, but I see an even greater risk in, okay, you pay the premium. How can you make sure that it's actually used, right? This is the next, yes. I mean, you have to work with very big logistics carriers in order yeah. to make sure they have a good governance on that.
Yeah.
And then even then, right, it might be that the truck is actually the fifth tier supplier in the chain. So it is hard to control, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. So one key to this really is collaboration, where we are yeah. again. That's my hobby horse. I mean, yeah. you can call me at night between 3 and 4 and you have a problem, you know, getting people together. I'll brainstorm with you immediately on the spot how to get collaboration going, and that is something that has actually helped us to propel mm-hmm. that we work very close with our logistics service providers on those challenges.
Perfect. So now combining both topics, risk and sustainability, I think they are deeply interlinked because they yeah. often rely on similar data sets from an input perspective, but also similar ways of creating outputs. What is the value of managing risk and sustainability, everyone singled out, but also together?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right, first of all, with your observation that they feed off the same data. It's network data, right? It's volumes, it's costs, it's CO2, that sort of thing. And then what's the value in it? Well, I mean, for me, it's quite simple. If my team does a good job in proactively managing risks, as in identifying there might be an issue coming up, assessing what's the impact, developing a mitigation strategy as a response that provides us with an opportunity not to use air freight as a special freight option if, you know, things go down the drain, but to already have a plan B to keep our lead times and keep our delivery reliability promise, then we've avoided air freight, which immediately helps us in bringing down our CO2 or keeping it at parity. And that's the beauty of it. You need, again, lots of collaboration, transparency. And that's also the easiest way for me without having one single cent budgeted for sustainability topics, how I can reduce CO2. It's good for the company, it's good for the customer, and it's good for the environment. So the decision to pool risk management and sustainability under one umbrella, that was probably the best thing we could have done last year.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, obviously it's avoiding air freight, but also utilizing your resources effectively by avoiding yes. production outage, right? Because if you then scramble and keep maybe the production running longer or less efficiently, that's also a waste of CO2, frankly.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was talking obviously about scope 3.4 upstream emissions, yeah. which is for the transportation part. And then of course you have all those parts that go into the product itself, which is also part of scope 3. But yeah, it's very interconnected. Yeah. And that's why you need to also talk to all the other stakeholders involved in making the products, AKA suppliers.
Exactly. So now I actually want to go full circle to our very first question, which was creativity on your PhD.
Yeah.
So you now lead a team. They're in supply chain management and they are on a task to do something rather new in supply chain management with sustainability and risk. And for that, you need creativity. So how hard is this to putting creativity into practice?
Hard. I will be honest. The most precious thing that we're lacking is time. You really need to make time to create the space that people can come together and chip in all the different perspectives. So having that said, there's a few things that I could actually translate one-to-one from my research. And I didn't realize probably until you asked me in preparation to the podcast that I thought about it and was like, huh, you're actually walking the talk of your research. How so? I'll tell you. First of all, staffing. When I staffed my team and I got to handpick my people working in my team, I made sure that I had people from the different corners of the company. So I have people who know what disposition works like in a plant, you know, master planner work, scheduling and stuff, which is important for risk management. I have someone who works on, who also knows project management office structures to navigate and coordinate large-scale sustainability initiatives. I have someone who really digs down into data analytics, into reporting. I have someone who's very strong on training qualification processes. I have someone who's very strong on the transportation management background. So I made sure that I surround myself and I also expose the team to different perspectives in the team. So check mark done on the diversity. Mm-hmm. Regarding the leadership stuff, you would have to ask my team if I do a good job or not, especially in the different phases of the ideation process. I try to be very transformational in the beginning. Also, I'm something that you call in German Spielertrainer, so kind of player coach. Mm-hmm. So I really like to have my hands dirty, you know, in the mud with them, get the work done. But I realized, and that's a self-reflection thing I went through, that at a certain point, that gets away with the team process. And that's something I think I learned in the second into the third year of my industrial position, that as when you have the formal role of the leader, you need to pull out at some point, even if you're having fun, even if it hurts yourself, you know, because it's something you really like to work on. You have to pull out and find the next opportunity to, when the team is finished and you get into transactional mode to finish something, you can again be that, you know, transformational, building a space kind of leader. to give them the opportunity to get creative. So that's regarding the leadership stuff. Creative capabilities, I think it takes practice. And I think the team got better over the past year that we've been working together, that they are now aware of their own creative capabilities. And they also know how to build on each other. So there's also a time aspect in it. And then also a structural thing, we actually do. 3 times a year we meet, one entire day. We have strategy workshops where we have some playtime at the beginning, warm-up games to really get in kind of a mood. Then we have some team reflection stuff. And then we also do an entire afternoon of content-related stuff, doing our roadmap. And in between, we also schedule working meetings that are dedicated to a single topic. Sometimes it's just a topic. We go in and we start brainstorming because we don't know where to start. Sometimes it's a specific question. And then while we're approaching the meeting, people put questions in, you know. Sometimes these questions actually already have answers because the team already did some research up front. So I think over the past year, it really played out that we had team workshops in between single meetings. And then you also have to let it go. So I had to pull back and I had to trust that the team fills that space that we've built structurally with life. And that really happens. Does it happen often enough? For my taste, not. But I think we've already come a great way. And the next step for me is to infect left and right other teams to do the same thing, to work collaboratively with us.
That drives us to the topic of change management. You want to instill change and being creative to other teams, which is great. But also your topic itself, risk and sustainability, needs a great amount of change management because it often is seen as the distraction from the day-to-day operations, right? So although it's deeply interlinked to day-to-day, it's still another topic that they might think they haven't managed before and now they have to. So you have a marketing background, you have worked on that in the past. So what is your style of driving the change and telling people, hey, this is something you naturally have done before because you're born firefighter. How do we do the, let's work together on this.
Yeah. It's a very true observation that it's seen still as a distraction, even though if it happens, so if stuff actually happens, it's seen as very, very valuable. But I always go around saying the best enterprise risk management you don't see, because if stuff doesn't happen that you have to firefight, risk management worked. Now I realize that even the best enterprise risk management cannot, you know, there's always going to be some firefighting, but you're going to try to keep it to the minimum. So in between events, when stuff is really, you know, there's a burning platform, in between there's really the work that needs to be done. And that's the hard part, because it's out of sight, it's out of mind, it's the stuff can go wrong. And this is the part where I think my big, very my internal drive, my idealistic way for, hey, it needs to get done, and I have lots of commitment, motivation. I don't need any extrinsic motivation to get things done. That helps, A, persistence, and B, my interest for people and what drives them. I sit in meetings, even if they're not super relevant for me, I sit in just to learn how do they speak, what issues do they face, how do they make decisions, to learn how I can kind of, you know, jump the bandwagon and slip in here and there little doses of risk management related topics, sustainability related topics, because every small move you make gets you to a goal at some point. It might not be fast, not as fast as I think for my taste it should go, but you're moving. So that's one thing. The other is storytelling. So if you found a compelling case and you actually had commitment buy-in from the other people that you need to work on, I don't know, network, the network management team, the purchasing team, the transportation management team, even maybe C-suite level management, you share those stories. Other people would say business case, present a business case. But for me, a business case is nothing else but a story that if it's told well, people buy. And that's backed up with numbers. And that's typically how I do it. And then you can also fight these seemingly conflicting KPIs, such as bringing down costs and investing in sustainability, for instance, or investing in building up an alternative route from a risk management point of view.
Yeah. Great. So on the next one, maybe a short answer, because it's a little bit outside of the topic. But in this podcast, we have talked a lot about control towers in the past. And yeah, that control towers are vital. I know that Scheffler is working on control towers as well. What is your personal perfect control tower setup?
Mm-hmm. The classic answer is depends. Now, what matters is, what does it depend on, Ulf? For me, a control tower needs to serve the company. A control tower shouldn't be set up for the sake of having a control tower, but it should serve a function. And the function it serves is to give transparency, enable real-time decision-making based on objective data that uses end-to-end thinking and is digestible for stakeholders that work with it. Having said that, the first step before you even think about the concept of a control tower is that you need to understand the organization that you're facing. Is it a centrally organized? Is it a decentral? Is it a hybrid? Because depending on the answer regarding the structure and the governance structure of a company, the setup of the control tower is different. It's not like that you have someone like a team, the control tower team, sitting somewhere and making all the decisions for a company in crisis mode. No, it should be something that supports the daily business routine of a company. It should be something that I would look at daily on a routine basis to make my decisions, to monitor, control, and see if I have to take action or not. So the five things that I mentioned, transparency, cross-functional or end-to-end, being presented in a digestible format, all of these need to be documented into specifications, so to say, right? That then you would also go make rounds with all the different stakeholders that you have in a company, especially as a C-suite level management, to get buy-in. And only then I would probably look into getting it done. Because for me, yes, the technology behind it, I'm not into technology itself, right? There's experts who can do that. But as long as you don't have buy-in and technology doesn't fit your structure, you will never get someone to work with it. So that's why I think you need to first do your homework before you let the experts do that job.
Perfect. Super. Can't agree more, actually. So coming to the last question, which is the hobby question.
Yeah.
You are having a stressful job being in supply chain management, and they're in risk, which is a super stressful thing. So what is your outlet from relieving that pressure?
Yeah. I mean, maybe if people listen to me now, they sense I have lots of energy, and I do have to get rid of from time to time. So sports is my natural outlet. Right now I'm a bit handicapped with my knee surgery, with my knee up right now, recording this podcast. It'll be running for sure again. In the meantime, what I do is I keep my head busy. I distract it from day-to-day stuff by listening to audiobooks, actually. I've really discovered that over the past year. I spent lots of time in the car. So that gives me also different perspectives, you know, on leadership, on sustainability, on risk management, but also other things. Like I love listening to autobiographies because it helps you to understand how someone else would solve a problem. And for the rest, it's just being outside in nature, even sitting somewhere, looking at the sky. I mean, it sounds trivial, but just sitting and not doing anything, that can be so precious. And I realized by doing that, normally I would just run somewhere. You know, I'm outside, I run, I do sports. But right now I'm kind of forced to sit somewhere with my kids, just watch them play. And that does a lot. And that's maybe something that I would like to encourage everyone to do who listens to this right now. I mean, you also have a very busy life style, Ulf. It's really healing sometimes to sit somewhere and don't do anything. You know, all that thinking that you can do, it's amazing how what kind of it opens up perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm bound to do right now, but soon I'll be running again. So
yeah, no, I'm a big fan of being outdoors as well.
I know. Yeah.
And with that, Nadine, thank you so much for being on the podcast. That was amazing. And it shows the passion you have for the topic of sustainability and risk and supply chain in general. So very inspiring. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. It was an honor to talk to you here. Thank you.
Of course. And with that, I want to say to our viewers and listeners, have a nice day and bye-bye.
This was Supply Chain Pioneers. Thanks for watching, listening, or however you are enjoying this podcast. You can find Supply Chain Pioneers on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all other major podcast players, as well as on YouTube at Ulf Talk Supply Chain. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment. See you next time.